I'm Commission President John Creighton, reconvening the regular meeting of the Port of Seattle Commission for March 25th, 2008. The time is now 4:15 p.m. We're meeting in the International Conference Room at SeaTac Airport. Present with me today are Commissioners Davis, Hara, Bryant, and Tarleton, and Port CEO Te Yoshitani, and Director of Commission Records Donna Nguyen. I'd like to point out the exits in case of emergency. They are the doors to my left on the east side of the room, the three doors on the east side of the room. Now, I'd like to ask everyone to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We don't have any minutes of prior meetings to approve today, and we don't have a unanimous consent calendar. We don't have any scheduled orders of business, of special business, but I would like to ask for a moment of silence for the captain, chief engineer, and crew members of the Alaska Ranger who perished the other day. They are not tenants of Fisherman's Terminal, but they are based here in Seattle at Lake Union, and our heart goes out to them and their families. Okay, the first regular item of business on the agenda is item 6A, update on the audit action plan.
Mr. President and members of the commission, this is the regular audit action plan. Dakota Chamberlain will be provide the briefing, and just a reminder to the public that all of this is on our website, continually updated every other week. And so if you miss any of the briefing, you can check it out on the website. Dakota.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners, Mr. Yoshitani. I'm here today to provide a regular update on the port's response to the SAO performance audit and our action plan. On March 20th, the port's new central procurement office was functionally established and Dwayne Lee was appointed as the interim director. As Mr. Yoshitani has previously announced, the port will be creating a new capital development division. This represents that division along with the other existing port divisions. The CPO will be included in the port's organizational structure as part of this new division, along with engineering, port construction services, and project management. The central procurement office will be comprised of parts of existing port departments and will centralize much of the procurement process, including administration of construction contracts, procurement of goods and services, procurement of capital purchases, administration of small works contracts, and oversight of personal and professional services. In addition to completing the work necessary to establish the CPO, the port has notified staff of the fraud awareness and prevention policy. To date, we have completed 9 recommendations and 62 action steps, and as noted here, we're tracking very close to the projected schedule. While keeping focused on the details of completing individual action steps, staff continues efforts such as supporting the Resolution 3181 subcommittee and tracking items central to the Commission's decision to provisionally lift the moratorium. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dakota. Comments or questions from the Commission? Commissioner Tarleton?
Dakota, thank you very much, and I just want to remind everyone, Resolution 3181 is the delegation of authority document that Commissioner Davis and I have been working with Dakota and his team to present the proposed revisions as a draft to our fellow commissioners, and the port CEO, Yoshitani, has also been involved in these discussions. Dakota, I just wanted to ask one simple question. You said you have worked on 62 action steps in the audit response plan. What are the total number of individual actions that you envision are going to come out of this audit response plan?
It's 144 or 146, I believe. It's in that neighborhood.
Substantial. Thank you.
Yes. All right. Further comments or questions from the commission?
Thank you.
Thank you, Dakota.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. President, the next policy and staff briefing is the greenhouse gas emissions briefing and possible commission action. We'll have two presenters, Russ Simonson and Mary Vigilante.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mr. Yoshitani. We're here today to report to you on the greenhouse gas emission inventory that was released about a month and a half ago. And the inventory was prepared to really give SeaTac a sense of where our largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions are and to begin thinking about what action steps we might take to address them in the upcoming years would include. So I'm going to turn it over to Russ Simonson, who's a Port of Seattle Senior Environmental Program Manager, and our consultant, Mary Vigilante, who actually performed the emission inventory. And we'll go through where the sources of emissions are, what we're currently thinking we may do to address those, and we're happy to answer any questions in the midst of the presentation.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mr. Yoshitani. This is Mary Vigilante, and I'm going to let her lead the presentation off with the first few slides, and I'll pick up after her presentation.
I'm going to go ahead and just jump right into greenhouse gases, what they are, and how we went about our evaluation. We really focused in on the primary greenhouse gas pollutant, carbon dioxide, but we wanted to note that there are a number of other pollutants that do represent greenhouse gases, which in their generation basically result in a blanket around the Earth's atmosphere that help retain and generate heat within our atmosphere. In looking at airport sources, there are basically six different types. In some instances, there can be more than six types, but basically six categories of sources of emissions of greenhouse gases. We have focused primarily on the top four of those activities. I will note that the evaluation of greenhouse gases at airports is really in its infancy stage, and so we ended up pulling together different methodologies in order to bring together a comprehensive inventory, and this really is the Port of Seattle paving the way, trailblazing, if you will, for looking at airports in a cohesive way and greenhouse gases. In focusing on the greenhouse gas-related emissions, we wanted to note that the types of sources that occur at an airport generate greenhouse gases that are very similar to any other source, the dominant one being aircraft. And when you really look at greenhouse gases, particularly CO2, carbon dioxide, is the dominant source of emissions that are occurring, which is why our inventory focused on that pollutant. In looking at putting together a methodology for greenhouse gases, we look to all the different resources that are available. And when it comes to the criteria pollutants, the pollutants for which we have health-based standards, there is a standard methodology. But for greenhouse gases, particularly in the aviation environment, there isn't. We look to a myriad of different sources that have different methodologies for the types of activities that might occur, and we took from those the different methods that we felt made best sense for looking at an airport's emission sources. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the EPA, the World Resource Institute, and ICLEI, whose name keeps changing but is basically the organization that represents county and other city organization environmental initiatives. Probably the most important part of our emissions inventory was focusing in on the emissions that are truly associated with the Port of Seattle activities, which then takes us into a category of looking at the operational boundaries and the organizational boundaries. So we started our process by focusing in on the aviation division and the operational boundaries of SeaTac Airport, and then followed the methodologies that WRI and IPCC have pioneered at looking at direct and indirect as well as optional emissions, which then say we need to look at the things that the Port of Seattle has ownership and control of. And when we think about the dominant source of an airport aircraft, the Port of Seattle doesn't have ownership or control of those dominant sources of emissions. So many entities that are doing inventories now exclude those from their inventory. Well, we felt that wasn't really representative of looking at truly an airport's emissions. So we wanted to capture those and identify those associated with the Port of Seattle's aviation division and identify those as the direct and the indirect activities, but then also report as optional emissions those associated with the tenants and particularly capturing the aircraft component. We've identified in our slide how we've broken down the different sources of emissions, but probably what's most important is to get in and talk about the specific quantity. And I will note that early on we released a draft report and we've since corrected for an error in one of the calculations that dealt with the shuttle activity at the airport. We had reported over 5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. We've brought that down based on a correction, and you'll see in the final report. And we've shown that of the emissions that are owned and controlled by the Port of Seattle, about 1.4% of the total emissions, or about 66,000 tons of CO2, are emitted by activities the Port of Seattle directly owns and controls. 90% of the emissions occur by the tenants, and the remaining portion by the public who accesses the airport. We then, in order to facilitate the activities that you're going to be looking at of reducing these emissions, we wanted to go in and identify for each of those categories of ownership and control what were the key sources so that you could identify what were the emissions and then look at ways of reducing it. And with the corrections that we made in the analysis, again, 1.4% of the emissions were Port of Seattle, the dominant sources being the facilities, the energy necessary to power your facilities, the passenger vehicles on your on-airport roadway system are really the dominant sources of the emissions. Then we took a look at the airline tenant owned and controlled category and identified that aircraft are the obvious major source of emissions. About 99% of the tenant category of emissions are associated with aircraft, and 90% of those are at aircraft operating above 3,000 feet. We then, which is probably most unique with this inventory, is looked at the operating modes under 3,000 feet because there are areas that the Port of Seattle does have some influence over, and we've identified that to aid in your future evaluations. We then took a look at public owned and controlled, the vehicular access principally to and from the airport, and identified passenger vehicles throughout the region that come to and from the airport, the hotels and parking lot shuttles, and then the employee commute. Chris, you want to?
Sure. And from here, what we did going into this, developing this report, was we wanted to view this as a tool that we could use to develop a technical plan with an eye towards establishing goals in a carbon conscious world. And so we wanted to look at the programs and the advocacies that the Port of Seattle undertake and seeing if we can influence it based on a carbon emission inventory and just keep that fresh eye on that with this report. This slide shows some of the Port of Seattle owned and controlled emission projects that could have influence on reducing greenhouse gases at the airport. I'm just going to bring up a couple as examples. The Hotel Courtesy van, we're looking at a project that might consolidate 35% of some of the real close-in hotels. To give you an idea, there are 61 hotels that service the airport, 477,000 trips a year. And of the hotels that are within about a mile and a half, there are 377,000 trips. And we think, conservatively, we could shave off 35 up to 50% of those trips if we had some sort of consolidation in place. That is where we would pair hotels up, twos, threes, and such, and use a ubiquitous clean energy vans to carry passengers from the airport to and from the hotels. And we think we could see about 1,000 tons a year savings with such a program. Next one is the garage wayfinding. You may have seen as you came in, we're still in the trial phases of trying to get folks to the parking stalls very efficiently, not only as a customer service, but also it will reduce emissions. And we did take a look at what that project could save in CO2 and first order of approximation sort of thing, about 15 tons a year. So there are inherent benefits of that program as well. As for the public owned and controlled operations, this is where our circle of influence comes in. Things that we could do to help reduce emissions outside of our direct control, and one of which would be a green rental car fleet, talking with the rental car facilities, rental car companies, in negotiating the rental car facility, kind of brought up green cars and, what could be provided to help make a greener fleet, whether it's E85. Been working with the Puget Sound Clean Cities Coalition to see about siting E85 stations in and around around the rental car facility, so that could be a benefit. Considering plug-in hybrids, would that be possible with a plug-in station, so on and so forth. Also, the taxi efficiencies. One of the projects that had occurred already, and we did it for mission purposes primarily, was the CNG station. We distribute about 1.2 million gallons of gasoline equivalents of CNG. And CNG is a low carbon fuel, so by burning it, you're producing about 20 to 25% less CO2 out of a tailpipe than you are if you were to use standard gasoline or diesel. And we're looking at maybe enhancing the infrastructure around the airport for CNG as well. And as for the airline tenant operations, a couple of the examples I'll pull out here. Again, one would be very good for us to work with, and we've already gone down the road investigating, is the preconditioned air. Preconditioned air is a project where we would supply cabin air to the aircraft when they're at the gate so that they could turn off their auxiliary power unit, which is a turbine engine. And if they're able to do that, we estimate conservatively could see about 5 million gallons of Jet A savings, Jet A fuel savings a year, which would equate to about 40,000 tons of CO2. So that is a project that, if we can install a centralized unit, not only is there cost benefits for the tenants and airlines, there is a benefit for us as well. Ramp tower efficiencies. Ramp tower is a aircraft control center. Once the aircraft's land is on the tarmac, the air traffic control center hands off the aircraft to the ramp tower. And the ramp tower is able to efficiently move aircraft around to and from the gates. So one project I did analysis on was some enhanced software where they were looking at, with this software, they could reduce taxi in times by a minute. And with that minute, in a year, we could save about 6,000 tons of CO2. For every minute 737 taxis, it's burning about 9 gallons of fuel. 747 is more like 30 gallons of fuel. So whatever we could do to kind of reduce that, that would be a good influence. Continuous descent approach, another area for advocacy. If the airport can help participate and move that along, that could see savings of a half a ton of possibly of a per flight landing. Just what it does, continuous descent, it uses this natural glide path of the aircraft instead of stair-stepping down, which does take power. You kind of plan out ahead a little ways. So air traffic control has to manage the aircraft a little further out, but then you can bring the aircraft in on a more natural glide path, and it does reduce fuel use. And with that, I do have Dennis McLaren from the Clean Air Agency, who we have used on many venues before, but we did give his agency a copy of this report, asked that they take a look at it, see if there was anything we should work with in this report, just to make sure it was a valid way to do inventorying. And Dennis, thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the commission and members of the staff. As Russ said, we have had a chance to review the document and give comments back to staff, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be involved in the review of the document. It is groundbreaking in many ways. It's very clear, it's very transparent, and it's very clear in identifying where there are limitations in the methodologies, and it's groundbreaking in some of the suggestions that it makes. So we're very pleased with the document overall and think it's an excellent piece of work. And we think also that measuring your greenhouse gas emissions is a great way to get started in reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, because you can't, you certainly can't know what you're doing and know what your opportunities are without first having gone through the process of having a good inventory. So this is a critical first step, and it's an excellent document. So we're really pleased that the port's taken the leadership to do that. And also because the port has shown leadership in working with us and partnering with us in reducing its air emissions both at the airport and the seaport, we're confident that the port will now see this as an opportunity to be a leader in reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the airport as well. And I've looked at the resolution that is in front, or the motions that are in front of the commission as well. I think they're very complete, and they identify a number of the things that can be done and that would be productive steps in reducing your greenhouse gas footprint or your carbon footprint. And one of the things that I did want to point out is that while I really commend the port and the staff for accounting for the aircraft emissions above the 3,000 feet foot level, the transit emissions, it's really important not to lose sight of what you actually do own and control, which are the emissions on the ground and certainly the emissions that you can influence, which are your customers, your tenants, the folks that come to and from the airport. And on the aircraft side, the port can be a very strong force in influencing national and international rules, which will soon be dealing with CO2 from aircraft, as well as the criteria pollutants. We've been disappointed in the international progress on the criteria pollutants, but there is an opportunity, and Elizabeth is very active nationally and can be influential in that process, and we'd like to be partners on that as well. There are a couple of comments that I would make. One is that, and I was pleased to see this in the presentation, the ground support equipment, electrification of ground support equipment is something that has real potential and should have a relatively short payback period for tenants as well. So that's something that I think is low-hanging fruit. We've had some opportunities in the past to try and get that started, and for various reasons it hasn't gotten moving, but that is a critical opportunity. Also, we strongly support the concepts of implementing next-generation aircraft air traffic control technology and flight operational changes that were mentioned by the staff. We think continued federal R&D funding for expenditures on aircraft propulsion and emissions reduction technology and so forth is something that you can be supportive of and help keep that moving in the right direction. I've also noted that in the motions you support some of the efforts to support petitioning EPA and ICAO to take the right steps, and those are really important things to do. We've been trying to influence the IMO on ship emissions, and I think just as importantly on the aircraft side, you can influence that, and the Port of Seattle is a significant enough player that you can make a difference in that regard. And finally, I agree with Section 3 of the resolution, which requires periodic airport inventorying and tracking progress on reducing emissions. That is a crucial step in seeing where you're going and moving forward. And we'd like to be partners with the port staff on this. We partner very well on a lot of projects, and this is another area where I think we can partner well together. So thank you for the opportunity to comment on this and be a part of putting this together.
Thank you, Dennis. If I could get your thoughts on, and not being an engineer, I'm treading, or a scientist, I'm sort of treading on thin ice here. But as I understand it, aircraft emissions are composed of a number of different elements that are under the Clean Air Act criteria pollutants. You have particulate matter, you have CO2, lead, NOx, and as I understand the existing technology, sometimes if you push on one area, like try to burn the engine hotter to reduce, say, CO2, then that increases the NOx. So is there any particular area that the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is concerned about with respect to the Puget Sound region, or are you just concerned about all the various elements?
Well, certainly we have a focus on particulates because that is a large driver of the health impacts. Interestingly, there's been a lot of research recently on black carbon or soot as a climate forcing element as well. So one of the things that we would suggest be added in the future to this is tracking black carbon and diesel soot and black carbon from aircraft fuel burn as well, because many of the most recent studies have shown that that might be the most effective way to, in the short term, have cost-effective ways to reduce our impact on climate. So not only would we get public health benefits by focusing on reducing particulate emissions, we get some greenhouse gas benefit as well. And just this week, there were publications that came out that indicate that there may be as much as three times the impact from black carbon or soot in climate forcing than the IPCC reports recently had, up to 60% of the impact of CO2. So there is low-hanging fruit in that arena, and on the seaport side, we've been working very closely with the port to reduce those types of emissions. The natural gas vehicles, the hybrid taxis, the natural gas taxis and the natural gas equipment is certainly a real progressive step that the port at the airport has taken over the past few years. But those shuttle vans and some of the other diesel equipment, some of the ground support equipment, and certainly the aircraft engines themselves, there is a lot of room for improvement there. And certainly on the aircraft engine side, we have not seen changes in the aircraft engine standards for a number of years. We think they're way behind on that, and that there could be fuel economy improvements as well as criteria pollutant emission reductions. It is, you know, there are always trade-offs when you have combustion, but we think that probably with technology advances, you can make progress in virtually all of the areas.
Okay. Thank you. Comments or questions from the commission?
No. Thank you.
All right. Well, in putting this briefing together, you know, I had the opportunity to go down to the Flying Green Conference down in California and got a lot of good information there. Mary was also in attendance. But I wanted to see if the commission could get sort of an overall sense of where the industry stands right now. And so to that end, we've invited some I guess I'll call them guest speakers, members of the industry that are working on cutting-edge technology and aviation and aviation propulsion. And so I'd like to call up Karen Fleckner, who is CEO of New Element, and Dr. Jack Brower, who is Associate Director of the National Fuel Cell Research Center. Over here to the right, if you...
Thank you.
And understand you have some slides as well.
I guess. Are we on? Oh, there it is. That's better. All right. Good afternoon, commissioners and members of the staff, Mr. Teoshitani. Let's see. We have this one? Okay. I'd like to introduce New Element, Inc. We are a company in Tacoma, Washington. We've been here for now 10 years, and we specialize in alternate energy products and services. Real briefly, our solutions are in fuel processing technologies, fuel cell generation systems, high-speed battery charging for things like electric vehicles and the like, and system integration management and control. Okay. So we have a short time, so I'll be brief. This slide really represents the thrust of our work for the last 5 years with the Boeing company, Phantom Works, and the U.S. Navy. And the gentleman to my right, Dr. Jack Brower, the UC Irvine's National Fuel Cell Research Center. Basically, what we were working on is reforming multi-fuel capability fuel cell systems. So what we're looking at here is looking at JP5 and then eventually looking at biodiesel, biojet, and the like. The idea is fuel flexibilities are crucial because you're going to have to look at different kinds of fuel and looking to implement different kinds of fuel that will make sense in the future of travel. So as you can kind of see just briefly, these are just showing the progressions of our iterative process through different reformation process, the process of making fuel into hydrogen for fuel cells. And then the far right, you'll see different options that we've done for an SAE study for the Navy and Boeing as well, of looking at what the trade-offs would be for various different configurations of ground support equipment, looking to eventually look at hybrids. And then that brings into our capability kind of the low-hanging fruit, if you will, of electric vehicles for ground support equipment. And the idea that we were working with the Navy and Boeing was to look at, first you have to get airplane quality on the ground and then spiral that technology into the air. So at that, I will turn this over to Dr. Jack Brower.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you, commissioners, for having me here today. Appreciate the opportunity of the staff, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk a little bit about airport and port emissions and some mitigating technology options. I have three major points that I'm going to try to make. The first is on greenhouse gas emissions, the second on greenhouse gas reduction activities in California. And there's a whole lot of them, so I definitely won't hit on all of those activities. And then I'll talk about some mitigating technology options. Greenhouse gas emissions in airports are pretty significant, but a relatively small portion of total greenhouse gas emissions, estimated about 3%. But there are also other emissions that were ably pointed out by Synergy and Mary in her presentation. And there's other localized and regional impacts. And most airports have done some things to address this. And in California, for example, compressed natural gas, CNG, is a very significant option that people have used to try to mitigate both criteria pollutant emissions impacts as well as greenhouse gas impacts. And you see CNG fueling stations in many California airports, shuttle and bus fleets that run on CNG, grant funds to convert cars to CNG, taxi trips that are required to be alternate fueled. But there's also a really big movement, especially in California airports, to consider electrification in many different ways. They're encouraging the use of electric ground support equipment, encouraging electric charging stations. And as a matter of fact, often when I travel up to LAX from Irvine, I drive one of our electric vehicles and I park and get a free charge, but also free parking. And that's quite attractive. We wish we had more electric vehicles that we could use for that. And then there's also preparations being made for additional charging activities, including ground support equipment. So what about greenhouse gas reduction activities in California? Well, Governor Schwarzenegger made a major announcement over a year and a half ago. And there's been lots of activity since then. I'll only touch on a few things. One is the California Goods Movement Action Plan, which was adopted in January of 2000. And part of it includes $3.1 billion that are allocated from his infrastructure investment bond measure that was passed by voters. And it's partially to support infrastructure and partially to support emissions abatement in the port, which includes the airport. And of course, there are all kinds of motherhood and apple pie reasons to do this, to generate jobs, to clean the environment, to improve quality of life, enhance public safety, and the like. But there are 200 individual actions that are identified by this. So it's actually a pretty significant thing. I just heard you guys talking about 146, 144 actions. So some similar, I think, types of things that are recommended there as you are considering here. The California Air Resources Board proposed an expanded list of early action measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions throughout the state, and it was approved in December. And that is summarized in this document that you see here, which identifies not only the measures themselves, but also the time frame in which the ARB will act on these measures. And I'm just going to pull out a couple of them that are related to ports and to airports in particular, and I'm summarizing them here. They have to do with commercial harbor craft, which was completed in the last quarter of 2007. The first quarter of 2008, the Green Ports Initiative was initiated. The low carbon fuel standards, the fourth quarter of this year, they're expected. Anti-idling enforcement, again, the fourth quarter of this year. Hybridization of medium and heavy duty diesel vehicles expected in the fourth quarter of 2010. So that's a little further out. And then again, you see this movement towards electrification. The last three measures here identified by the Air Resources Board, truck stop electrification, trucking and shipping refrigeration electrification, and electrification of air ground support equipment. These don't have specific dates yet associated with them because the Air Resources Board is still studying them. But there is this definite movement towards electrification. And just to show you that the Air Resources Board is keeping its word, I have the next slide, which shows that they actually have adopted the Green Ports Initiative. So that is proceeding. And the main two things they're doing is requiring 95% of container ships to take shore power and turn off their engines while in port. Okay, it's not going to be completely enforced until 2014 or something like that. But this is going. This is a major initiative that's already underway. There will be similar rules that will come through for bulk ships and containers later this year. And the Port Trucks Initiative also, it's going to basically take all pre-1994 trucks and convert them all to new technology by the end of next year already. And then by 2013, actually taking all trucks and lowering the emission standards for those trucks. So it's a pretty significant effort that's already underway. So what about some mitigating technology options? I'm going to speak only about technology options that I'm intimately familiar with. These are technologies that I work on. And the first that I'm suggesting, which is also in your plans I have read, is to consider fuel cell technology. And I'm showing here some large fuel cell installations that I think would be appropriate for the airport to consider. And one of them, as a matter of fact, you can easily see down in King County, Washington. It's at a facility in Renton, which is a wastewater treatment plant. It's a type of fuel cell installation that can provide clean, efficient power and also heating and cooling. Fuel cells can also be used in aerospace applications, and we've been fortunate to work with Boeing and work with NASA on a couple of different projects where fuel cells were actually considered onboard aircraft. And in particular, when you think about the auxiliary power unit, which is operated on the ground level, or in cases of emergency, solid oxide fuel cells may be used in the future. And proton exchange membrane fuel cells could be used also for onboard power, usually powered by hydrogen or methanol. We've done some good research on that topic. We have done a lot of work with zero emission vehicles. I mentioned driving one up to LAX just recently, but we have a whole system for both charging and for operating these vehicles within a web-based reservation system, tying them to mass transit and eliminating these short trips that have each startup emissions and, of course, emissions during regular operation. So it has a huge impact, which can also mitigate congestion as you try to get people off of the freeways and into the mass transit. And then finally, in the future, we expect fuel cell vehicles to make a difference as well. There is a need for both hydrogen infrastructure as well as fuel cell vehicle advancements, but these are well underway by all of the major automobile manufacturers, and we've been fortunate enough to work with Toyota and the Air Quality Management District in our area to begin that infrastructure development and testing. So I want to encourage action at SeaTac. Want to commend you for the statements that or the motions that you have before you. I believe they're consistent with the goals you have set forth for yourselves as a commission, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. excuse me, Dr. Brower, Ms. Fleckner. Are there any comments or questions from the commission?
Thank you. That was very helpful. Yeah, very informative.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for having
me. You're welcome.
And with that, we have a motion before us. And the genesis of this motion, I'd like to set a little bit of groundwork for. The past couple of years, as we've been working through the Northwest Clean Air Strategy, we've gotten a lot of commendation for the groundbreaking nature of it, the fact that it's a three-port agreement, the fact that we're pushing forward on a voluntary basis, whereas other ports, say down in Southern California, are legally required to do it because their air quality is so bad down there. But a lot of the constituents around the airport said, okay, well, you're doing these great things in terms of pushing forward emissions reduction strategies at the seaport. How about the airport? And we are doing a lot of good things at the airport in terms of electrification of gates, allowing planes to plug in when they're at gate and not have to run their engines, conditioned air at the gates so airplanes don't have to, again, run their engines and burn fuel to keep the airplanes air-conditioned and climate-controlled. Things like the taxi fleet, the STETA taxi fleet at SeaTac. One thing I learned down at this Flying Green conference, and it's always great to go to conferences like this to see what other airports are doing. Vancouver, BC, the airport up in Vancouver was really trumpeting their alternative energy taxi fleet program. And the question was posed, well, how much of your taxi fleet have you converted so far? And the presenter said 25%. And, you know, the audience thought that was really, really great, which it is really, really great. But then someone, and not me, I'll have to say, pointed out that SeaTac Airport, 100% of our taxi fleet is CNG or hybrid or alternative energy. So I think we're doing a lot of great things at the airport, but I also think we can do more. And I think a lot of the issues at the airport, you know, someone would argue, well, the Port Commission, we really can't do much because it's most of these issues are under federal control. And I think that's true. But I do think that the Port Commission can step up and use its bully pulpit to advocate with the federal government to start moving on a lot of these issues. A lot of the technology is already there to start reducing aircraft emissions in terms of next generation air traffic control, if we can get that funded, in terms of operational changes, like Russ mentioned, continuous descent approach, things like de-thrusted engine takeoff, where you're taking off not at full power, so you know it reduces the nitrous oxide. So there are a lot of measures that are out there that if we just move forward as a nation and implement, we can have a significant impact. Also, I think, you know, part of the motion also expresses support for Attorney General Jerry Brown's petition to the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions of aircraft engines. And again, I think that's important to be done on the federal level. You know, and some might say, well, that puts us at a competitive disadvantage with other nations. Well, you know, we have Europe that's well ahead of us on these efforts. We have British Columbia right to the north of us that's implementing a carbon tax already, and their airport will be subject to that carbon tax soon, if only with respect to internal domestic flights. And then the last part of it is asking the staff to work collaboratively with our tenants to figure out strategies going forward for reduction of greenhouse gases. And I think that's important because, as Mary and Russ pointed out, over 84% of the emissions categorized in this emissions inventory were resulting from aircraft. So you can't have a credible greenhouse gas emissions reduction strategy without addressing the aircraft issue. But, you know, as we've done with the seaport, I think it's much better to work together with our tenants on a collaborative approach to really push forward change. So with that, I'd open it up for comments or questions from my fellow commissioners. Commissioner Tarleton?
I concur that this groundbreaking effort to assess greenhouse gas emissions and establish a methodology that can be tested by others and that can be improved as we learn about new data and learn from our experience and our experiments and our failures as well as our successes is crucial. And I would just follow up on a comment that Dennis McLaren made, that the port has immense influence if it chooses to use it. And one of the things that I'm always reminded of is that the federal government doesn't have a lock on new ideas. How do you think they come up with the ideas for new legislation and new policies? They come from the ground up with people like Dr. Brower and people like our staff and our consultants who are feeding them information about what is happening on the ground. And so I completely endorse the idea of the motion, and I would also encourage that we share the greenhouse gas emissions inventory with the FAA and with other federal agencies, not just the motion, because the inventory gives data and will create new ideas for how to do it better. And that's what our goal is.
Thank you. Commissioner Hara, and then Commissioner Bryant.
Maybe just one additional comment. You might have read in the paper when Empyrean, which was Seattle Biodiesel, of which I think a number of us have toured their plant here, provided the biofuels for Virgin to try an experimental flight, and now they're trying to get the metrics as to what's happened on that. So I believe we have some other partners that we can also work with, along with Karen Fleckner and with Dr. Brower and others, because I do think we're at a stage where this region clearly is at the forefront of greenness or sustainability. And I think the Port of Seattle, with our mantra of being the cleanest, greenest, most energy efficient port, should also be adding to that and working closely with our other partners in the region. So I think this goes a long ways to begin to show our support.
Commissioner Bryant?
Well, I just want to thank the staff and our guests for giving us a very thorough and useful briefing on this matter, and thank Commissioner Creighton for translating that wonderful briefing into really meaningful action. And I would just encourage all my colleagues to support this motion.
Thank you. Commissioner Davis.
I concur in all the comments.
Move the question.
But one of the things you do say in the statement of support, which I completely concur in, is we are in another era now of global concern about our environment. But at the Port of Seattle, we also did something that was new, set a precedent, and that was in noise reduction. Early on, before we started the third runway, we set that goal of establishing that before we did anything about enlarging or expanding here. And I think this is another step where we're setting that mark. And in that case, we did lead the nation. Other airports had to hurry up and catch up because, frankly, they didn't get as much money from the FAA after the FAA found out how much they'd given this airport. So this is a wonderful goal to start with, and I appreciate your work and the work of our staff. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis, and as long as commendations are going around, I shouldn't forget to mention Elizabeth Levitt and her great work as environmental director of the airport. A lot of this motion was really, in lion's share, her work. I think she had a little bit of heartburn in me trying to push the envelope, but that's what electeds do, respond to our constituent interests. And I do think, you know, while the best approach is in partnership with our stakeholders, we're also not here to coddle our stakeholders, but to challenge them. So, but Elizabeth has represented the port well on a number of different national and international aviation environmental working groups. So thank you for, and Russ as well, thank you for all your work. So with that, do I have a motion for approval of the motion before us?
I move to approve the motion regarding support of federal and local initiatives to address aviation greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you. Commissioner Tarleton has moved approval. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Just a point of order. Maybe we could read into the record just the titles that are underlined so that for the people who are listening into the streaming, they know what we're talking about here.
Very good. As Commissioner Davis recommended, this motion is regarding support of federal and local initiatives to address aviation greenhouse gas emissions. It is a motion by the Port of Seattle Commission to adopt the following efforts: support federal initiatives to reduce aviation emissions, reduce airspace operational or achieve airspace operational management efficiencies, to urge Congress to apply federal research funding, and to urge the federal government to adopt stronger standards by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Also to encourage airline operational practices, implementing mitigation and control measures, and to actively support a federal government relations agenda to advocate on behalf of new strategies for increasing public awareness as to the benefits of our initiatives. We also support and petition the EPA to adopt global warming regulations for aircraft. And then finally, we ask the CEO to support the development of targets to reduce airport and aircraft emissions at SeaTac.
And could I just add that it seems to me, since we're urging the federal government on and sort of lighting a firecracker, that we send this to our delegation so that they have some impetus to try to move forward with
it. And that is in the motion.
Exactly. Right. And I will take as a friendly amendment, although I don't think we need to take it as an amendment, but Commissioner Charlton had a good suggestion of including the actual document, the greenhouse gas inventory, along with the motion and a letter of support. So with that, all in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
If I may just add my 2 cents worth, I want to thank you for complimenting our staff. I think the commission knows that we have a staff that really is truly dedicated to trying to reduce our environmental footprint as well as reducing air emissions. But more importantly, I want to just applaud the commission for your leadership in this this whole effort. So thank you very much. The first item in Maritime is 7A, which is an authorization to negotiate a lease with City Ice Cold Storage and approve funds for design and permitting for an estimated amount of $180,000. And Mike McLaughlin and Tim Leonard will give the briefing.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mr. Yoshitani, we are here today to request your authorization for our Chief Executive Officer to negotiate an 11-year, three-month lease of Building 40 and adjacent supporting yard space at Terminal 91. That would be with our customer, City Ice Cold Storage. This request also includes approval of funds to complete design and required permitting related to removing a portion of the building on the south end of the structure in order to facilitate better traffic flow on the terminal between the piers and the upland area north of the bridge. The estimated cost for this engineering and permitting is $180,000. With our approval, once this initial work is complete and we are confident with the cost estimates for construction and demolition, staff will return to Commission requesting authorization to execute the new lease agreement and approval of the construction funding for the building demolition. We expect to be back to Commission in May for the next approval on this proposal. City Ice has been a long-term tenant with the Port of Seattle, one of our valued customers in the Seaport. They currently hold 5 separate leases at Terminal 91 for a variety of cold storage and warehouse facilities. They support the fishing trawler fleet out there and all their backload, offload efforts. They house a lot of product that comes from the trawlers and a lot of fish product that comes into this region. The Building 40 is currently occupied by their subtenant, Independent Packers, which they process fish product that comes in trucks and is repackaged and then stored in the cold storage facilities that City Ice manages. The traffic pattern in and around the facility has been a concern with the up-and-coming cruise terminal that will be opened in 2009. In the environmental impact review in the public process, that was pointed out that the current tenants want a clear separation between the activities that currently exist at the terminal and the future activities related to passenger traffic and throughput. So we came up with a plan that would work, that would allow that separation to occur, but it requires taking off the southernmost bay of the building, as noticed on the graphic there on the screen, which is approximately 5,000 square feet. That allows traffic to stay separate from the activities in and around the cold storage facilities that City Ice manages and also those that Trident manages just north of Building 40. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Tim Leonard, who will just kind of talk about the elements of the construction demolition project.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'd like just to add a little more information to the basic facts that Mike's already presented. As stated, you'll see on the graphic there, the extent of the demolition consists of the southernmost bay of building W40. We had a feasibility study performed last July by a consultant engineering firm and looked at this in conjunction with that, had discussions with the tenant, City Ice, as well as their subtenant, Independent Packers, took a tour of the facility, talked about their operations. As part of that study, or I should say as a result of that, it was determined that it's both structurally feasible and operationally feasible to perform the demolition as shown. In addition to the graphic that you see up there, I just wanted to reflect the one, or this shows a traffic pattern around the building. As Mike previously stated, it's to facilitate the traffic flow in and out of the proposed cruise terminal at T91. The proposed funding is to complete the engineering and design. The intent, as previously stated, is for us to come back at the time that is completed to seek approval for construction funds, which will be identified. The full scope will be identified as part of that design, of course, for those funds. And the intent is to have this improvement done prior to the start of the cruise season in 2009. Basic elements of the project, as they've been identified, are essentially the demolition of the existing South Bay, the construction of a new wall on the south end of the building, the relocation of some interior utilities such as electrical communications and a dry sprinkler system, and then finally the paving that's necessary in order to facilitate traffic in and out of the site there. So with that, I'd just like to turn it over for any questions that you may have at this time.
Thank you, Tim. Mike, are there any comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Davis?
I'd like to move approval and congratulate you on your negotiations. It's always hard for tenants who've been here a long time to make these changes and accommodate the new kinds of development that happen. And some of us have gotten calls with concern about this, but not really complaints, just you've done a good job. So thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's difficult.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis. Do I have a motion for approval of this item?
I did.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yes, you certainly did. Excuse me. All in favor of approving
aye.
This item?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Wait a minute. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. Thank you. The motion passes unanimously. Mike, Tim? Sorry. A little slow today.
Mr. President, the next item is 7B. This is an authorization to advertised for construction bids for Terminal 10 improvements in the amount of $450,000 for a total authorization of $530,000. And Michael Burke will provide the background for this.
Thanks, Mr. Yoshitani. Let me, I have to do two things at once here. That's two more things than I can handle. So give me a little chance here to get up here. So, and I clicked the wrong one, didn't I? What am I going to do? There we go. I also can't add, so I'm on item 7. So we're talking about here T10. Give you a little background on the location in case those of you weren't out there the other day. Terminal 10 is located on Harbor Island. It's kind of towards the top of the screen right here, just immediately west of Terminal 18. It's about a 10-acre site. The port acquired that site in the late 90s as part of the T18 expansion project. We utilized it primarily as a construction laydown and material recycling site for that time period. And for the last couple of years, we've been working somewhat unsuccessfully to try to find a more permanent use for the site. By the way, it originally was a Lockheed shipyard. It was one of the two Lockheed shipyard sites in the Outer Harbor area, the other one being at Terminal 5, which is now part of the APL terminal over there. So what staff has been looking at is fulfilling our environmental obligations to the Superfund site there for EPA and Lockheed to improve the drainage system on the area, add current drainage standards to it, and ensure that the outfall, whatever we use, does not disrupt the underwater cap of the contaminated sediments in the offshore area. So, and in doing those things, plus taking care of some of the ponds, it kind of looks like the Great Lakes of Harbor Island, as we saw yesterday. That'll make it a usable site for cargo, cargo operations, and especially specifically what we're looking at here as an interim site for truck parking, which we expect that it could handle approximately 200 trucks, help alleviate the issues going on in Georgetown until a more permanent solution for that is found. Right now, we're asking for basically $450,000 to increase the toll authorization to $530,000 for us to complete design on this project. We estimate the total project will be around $3.2 million if we're able to reuse the existing outfall. If we have to build a new outfall because there is design conditions, and that, I mentioned that very important environmental condition, not disrupting the offshore cap. If that requires a new outfall, then we get into more in the $5 million range, which some of the estimates have had. We're also hoping that we can get this project done in 9 months and get it up and running. We could, again, with a new outfall and the issues that brings up, that could extend that time period to 12 months or longer. The other thing we'll be doing now as we talk about interim truck parking is we'll be working with the trucking community, independent truckers, as well as the trucking companies, also with parking lot operators to pick a lot operator for the site, as well as work out the right operational constraints that we'll work the site under. And part of that will also be investigating other truck parking, and notably Ms. Yoshitani's stomping ground down in Oakland, where they have a couple of city-operated and a port-operated trucking facility, I believe, help us investigate what's going on there so we learn how to do this site as well. I think with that, I'll take any questions we have on this.
Thank you, Mike. Comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Hara?
Say in the future, we switch the use from parking to storage or something else. I take it the investment that's being done here will be an additive to any additional future use or other port use?
Yeah, this investment is what we're required to do no matter what we would use the site for. We have to finish off the environmental requirements for use of that site, as well as reduce the ponding out there to make the site even usable for any type of cargo operation. So there's really no specific measures that we're planning at this time to accommodate truck parking. Well, the fencing, the paving of the site all fit in with that use as well.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Further comments or questions, Commissioner Tarleton?
Mike, I'd just like to thank you and Charlie and all of the staff for being really innovative and creative in looking at parallel uses of the terminal while we work on the longer-term plan of expanding trade here. I think what we're trying to see is if we can make sure we have livable neighborhoods while we grow the trade that brings the family wage jobs here to Seattle. And I want to take this opportunity to thank the citizens of King County, because it's only with their support and their tax dollars that we're able to do the environmental and operational improvements to the site that make it possible for us to address the core mission of the port, which is to help create jobs and create economic vitality, but also to make sure that the port is not doing that at the expense of our neighbors, because we are going to be a good neighbor. And thanks a lot for all of your effort on a really short timeline. I realize we pushed you a little.
I'll take your thank for the team that's working on this deserves the credit. Thank you very much from them.
Further comments or questions from the commission? With that, we do have a number of members of the public signed up to make public comment, but why don't we put a motion on the floor first, and then we can. Commissioner Tarleton?
I move to approve the funding for the Terminal 10 upgrades.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Tarleton. First signed up, we have Mr. John Robert Jones. Mr. Jones?
Thank you.
And Mr. Jones, if you could state your name and if you're affiliated with an organization, your organization for the record.
Thank you, Chairman and Port Commissioners. My name is John Robert Jones. I'm a member and chairman of Washington Acorn of King County, and I'm also the president of Washington Acorn. I'd like to thank you for an opportunity to speak today. We are here today because we have a long way to go to fixing the port trucking problem. We have members all the way down the Federal Way affected by this problem. This seriously affects South Park, Georgetown, the Duwamish area, inner urban, but we also have trucks along the streets in Burien and every other low to moderate income neighborhood in South Seattle and South King County. There is a problem. This is a problem not solved by getting the trucks out of our neighborhoods. There are many factors, as outlined in ACORN members' 12 community demands to the Port of Seattle. It includes responsible development, responsible use of taxpayers' money, and responsible care of workers who at the port. Approximately 1,500 drayage trucks use the Port of Seattle every day. Yet these drivers, like many of our neighborhoods, are getting the short end of the stick. All drivers deserve to make a good living, and the big companies making all the money off the drivers need to step up and take care of these drivers. Long Beach and LA voted on a clean air plan that's way ahead of ours. Seattle, the Emerald City, Seattle needs to be leading LA on environmental issues, not the other way around. The parking lot is a good step. It's one of our 12 community demands, but it's a temporary solution to a permanent problem. ACORN members look forward to working with the port to develop a permanent solution to the trucking problem, one that works for the drivers, one that works for the communities. I ask every commissioner here today to sign the Good Neighbor Agreement with ACORN members, and let's get this moving, and let's take care of our city. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Next, we have Jenin Lawrence.
Hi, commissioners and the port. Thank you very much for giving it. Thank you. Are you hearing me?
Yes.
Okay, for giving us the opportunity to speak. My name is Jenin Lawrence, and I'm a proud ACORN member from Burien. And we're really very concerned that Seattle is lagging behind the ports of LA and Long Beach and Oakland, like John just got through saying. We're the Emerald City. And our clean air plan lacks the firm solutions of the benchmarks of LA Long Beach and that Oakland already have. They have mandatory standards, and that's if it's as long as anything remains, you get to do it or you don't, voluntary, it's not going to happen. And that's so the mandatory standards really need to be put in place in order to really make a difference. We think it's great. And it's and from being here the last time, I feel that you guys listened, and that's that you found a place for the trucks to park, and that's if and get them out of the neighborhoods. So that's really great. My question, if I'm understanding right, though, is that going to be like 12 to 18 months down the line, or is there something channeling them out of the neighborhoods now, getting them off the road, and that's if at peak hours when people are out there?
Goal is to have it within 9 to 12 months. We have to do the renovations, and the renovations in terms of the construction just have to happen. So we will keep working the problem with other members of the community during this reconstruction and renovation period.
Yeah. 9 to 12 months. Okay. Well, I just asked the possibility that this could be stepped up a tad bit, because people are still out there breathing the polluted air, and that's if fixing the trucking problem is really serious. The health benefits of old problems of the effects of old trucks unable to be properly maintained create a real health problem. And that's, and you know, I should know, I'm a nurse. Now, my mom is holding up some lungs that we made up here for you to get as a visual here. The little blue part and before in there is your nose going down your trachea into your lungs. And I left out the stuff in that stuff that goes into the lungs. But the deal is that you get to breathe. And that's if these large particulates that go into your lungs, and that's if, and then it causes this cough and this inability to breathe. It causes an irritation, and it puts things in spasm. And over time, it becomes permanent. It doesn't ever get better. And that's so your lungs are supposed to fill from the bottom up, and they should all be red. But what happens when they can't exchange gas, those lung sacs don't get to go. And that's if then the bottom part becomes dead, lungs become stiffer, and we're working and only breathing from the top part. You know, as far as the routes of the trucks even taken out when they're traveling, I recently moved from where I had a nice little green belt cushion. Okay, and I have more coughing. So I'd just like to say in this that the problem in that with the trucks and that's the truckers and that having to pay, and that's that they really can't afford to do that. They've had too many things dumped on them. And so they really have, the cost needs to be picked up by the trucking companies and by the shippers that are making the money, not the truckers. And just maybe a little place on that little island, and that's if where their trucks are in there, that they can go where they can breathe safely. That's rather than all the concentrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lorraine. Next, we have Lulu Emery.
Thank you. My name is Lulu Emery. excuse me. I'm a member of ACORN. I live in Dead Ridgeway, very close to port. I've been there for, I live in for Dead Ridgeway more than 12 years. I know some of the drivers who have, some of them my friends. I know I'm not a truck driver, by the way, but I live in there for 12 years. In the meantime also, they have enough problem trying to make their living on their own lives. Especially, they pay more than $400-$300 for the filling gas. They pay for the insurance, truck insurance, more than $2,000 a year. So these people, they work like seasonal workers. Especially, the good time for those people to work is like New Year or Christmas time. Rather than it's not, they're not working hard because there's no business. So why we cannot be charged driving for the parking? The being these companies is, I mean, the port company, they are the one make big money, not those drivers. Taking better than the care themselves. Parking lot is not short-term solution. And we want working those parking lot for the permanent solution. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michael McGrath. Mr. McGrath.
Good afternoon, members of the commission and their staff. My name is Michael McGrath, and I'm an ACORN member from South Park. ACORN members have been working on the port issue for almost a year now. And we are very concerned that Seattle is lagging behind the ports of Long Beach, L.A., Long Beach, and Oakland. And the our clean air plan lacks a firm solution and benchmarks that L.A., Long Beach already have. I applaud the commission on the proposal of the parking lot. We want things like a clean, safe parking place for our drivers, just like we want clean and safe neighborhoods. But we cannot charge the drivers to park there. That just won't work. The drivers already have a hard enough time making ends meet, and to charge the drivers to park is not a solution. It means the drivers will just have to add on one more thing to their problems, and which will add on problems to our neighborhood. The drivers shouldn't be paying, and taxpayers shouldn't be footing the bill. The big companies, the terminal operators, and the brokers making all the profits off the drivers should be stepping up and doing the right thing and taking better care of them. This parking lot is a short-term solution, and we want to work with the port to find a permanent solution, and that's why we're here today. And I'd like to thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Next, we have Heather Weiner.
Good evening. My name is Heather Weiner, and I am the spokeswoman for the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports, which is a coalition of conservation, health, labor, and neighborhood organizations. I have two primary comments about the parking lot proposal. My first comment, and I've mentioned this to a couple of commissioners, is just in terms of public process and transparency. I received a copy of the memo that was dated February, I believe, 12th. I received a copy of that memo last Friday, early afternoon. And so that gave us only a couple of days over Easter weekend. I'm Jewish, so I can't really use that as an excuse, but theoretically Easter weekend to review that document, to take a look at it, and to talk to our constituencies. So in the future, I would greatly appreciate a little bit more heads up and notice and release of those public documents. I know you've heard me say this before. The second issue here is the larger issue about the externalization of the costs of what is essentially an underground economy within our port drayage trucking here in Seattle, and in fact at ports around the country. And the externalization of those costs we have seen immediately in the port trucks parking in the neighborhood streets of Georgetown and Del Ridge and South Park. We've seen the externalization of those costs in high levels of diesel particulate matter coming from those trucks. And now we're seeing the externalization of the costs in the port providing a parking lot for those trucks. Those costs really should be borne by the people who are profiting off of that industry, and that namely are the trucking company owners and the shippers, not the truck drivers themselves, who are at the very bottom of this port's economic ladder, not the taxpayers. And really, it shouldn't be borne by us. This should be borne by the people who are profiting off of it. Now that I'm saying that, I don't want you to think that I oppose the parking lot, because we don't. We understand that this is an immediate solution. It is a temporary interim solution to get the trucks off the streets. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Those trucks require quite a bit of upgrades in order to reduce their pollution, but at least they will not be polluting immediately next to schools and next to people who might have health issues. But they still will be polluting in the Seattle airshed. They still will be causing health problems for the truck drivers themselves who drive them. And this is not an immediate solution to helping the truck drivers themselves climb up that economic ladder. Indeed, by charging for them to park there, we're going to be undermining their ability to pay their rent, their own health insurance, their fuel costs. Somebody mentioned that the Port of Oakland provides port truck parking. That is true, they do. However, I am told that many truck drivers do not use those port trucking lots because they cannot afford them. Was that 5 minutes or three? That was three, okay. So what my suggestion to the Port of Seattle is, if you are going to provide this interim parking lot, thank you for doing that. I charge the trucking companies to pay rent for their truck drivers to park there, or provide it free of charge, but please do not charge the truck drivers themselves.
Thank you, Ms. Weiner. And thank you everyone who took the time and the trouble to come out here and make public comments before the commission. I think they're all very good, valid comments. And Ms. Loreen, you made the point about the standards needing to be mandatory. And I think that's something that this commission very much agrees with. The trick is, how do we get there, impose mandatory standards without having a bunch of lawsuits slapped on us and being in court for years? So this commission is very, very much committed to addressing the issue that ACORN and others have brought forward to us. And thank you for your input and your advocacy. With that, we have a motion before us for approval of item 7B. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 The motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Mr. President, the next item is 7C, authorization to execute amendment to termination agreement.
Mr. Yoshitani, if we could take a short 5-minute break and recess.
Absolutely.
We'll be back here in about 5 minutes. Thank you. Good afternoon. This is Commission President John Creighton reconvening the regular meeting of the Port of Seattle Commission for March 25th, 2008. Mr. Yoshitani.
Thank you, Mr. President. Next item is 7C. This is an authorization to execute an amendment to the termination agreement with Trans-Pacific Container Corporation, commonly known as TRAPAC, for Terminal 30. And Michael Burke will provide the background here.
Thank you, Mr. Yoshitani. You've simplified a little bit here. I was going to have to introduce some initials off the bat here. The Trans-Pacific Container Corporation, or TRAPAC, is the terminal operating arm of Mitsui Lines, or MOL, we'll use later on. TRAPAC used to lease Terminal 30, and in 2002, the port and TRAPAC negotiated and executed a termination agreement of that lease. Part of that deal was for MOL to give a guarantee of 50,000 lifts of cargo to be moved through the Port of Seattle through the year 2010. And then basically the intent of that guarantee was not to generate revenue for the port, but was to generate and continue business by MOL through the Port of Seattle. And basically MOL has met that guarantee level every year through 2007. Unfortunately, in 2008, or late 2007, MOL informed us that starting in 2008, they would be shifting about half of their volume down south to the Port of Tacoma to run it through one of their alliance partners' terminals, the Hyundai terminal down in Tacoma, and they would not be meeting this guarantee for the last 3 years. They did also come to us and ask that we waive the guarantee in the future. Staff responded that we would not waive the guarantee, but we would consider proposing to you that we would modify their guarantee to reduce the volume but increase the number of years that they would be providing a volume, giving us cumulatively a larger volume guarantee, but also something they can continue to meet and hopefully at a level that would encourage them not only continue to bring business into the Port of Seattle, but return their volumes back in the future as business circumstances change. So in the bottom line, right now the guarantee would be 50,000 a year or 150,000 lifts through 2010. We're proposing to increase that to 175,000 lifts, but give them through 2013 to meet that guarantee. So with that, like I said, we think that meets the original intent of the agreement of really working for business and not to generate revenue from enforcing a penalty. And with that, I'll take questions on this.
Thank you, Mike. Are there any comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Hara?
Yeah, I move that we adopt 7C. I think it's important that we maintain a relationship with MOL as long as we possibly can, recognizing that they have decided to move a good portion of their containers down to Tacoma. But on once again, this is another important partner we've had for a good number of years, and I recognize that initially when the initial lease was canceled on T30, so we could convert that over, but this still retains an ongoing relationship, at least actively up until the turn, until
2013, yes, correct. That's an excellent point. They've been an excellent customer of the port for a number of years, and we do believe it's important to maintain good relationships and help encourage them to bring back that volume, hopefully to their other alliance partner, APL, at Terminal 5.
Thank you. Commissioner O'Hara has moved for approval of item 7C. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. The motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Mike. Now go catch your ferry. And Mr. Yoshitani, that is the end of the marine items. We're now on to aviation items. We did have one item of new business with regard to staff coming back and giving us an update on the SkyCap issue. And we have a number of members of the public signed up for public testimony. Michael, if you could just give us a brief update and then we could hear from members of the public.
Thank you, President Creighton. Good afternoon, commissioners. As you'll recall, during the month of March, both Southwest Airlines and Alaska Airlines terminated their service contracts with Huntley Incorporated, an SEIU employer of SkyCaps here at SeaTac International Airport. On the 11th of March, a member of SAGE and two SkyCap employees came to the commission in open session and under new business to express their concerns about not being given adequate opportunity to apply for those jobs with the new employers, Bags Inc. for Alaska Airlines and IRAM for Southwest Airlines. As a result of the sincere concern expressed by the commission, airport staff, including Mr. Reese, Gary Schmidt, and myself, have all been in regular contact with Alaska Airlines in the last 2 weeks. Our understanding of the matter now is that all SEIU members have been given the opportunity to interview for the new jobs, and unfortunately five have not been offered jobs with Bags Inc. I've been in contact with Carrie Fassler from SEIU, and that's my understanding as of today that of the 20 positions that were available at Alaska Airlines, they have filled all of those, but there are five people, to my understanding, SEIU members that have not been offered employment.
Okay. Thank you. And is there any update in general as to the, I know we had set a deadline for the wheelchair issue.
We did, President Creighton. I met yesterday with Jeff Kunjan, Ed White, and Todd Sproul from Alaska Airlines. Paul Bintinger from our legal department accompanied me. And we had, as you mentioned, given the airlines a March 1 deadline to come back to us with an answer as to whether or not they'd participate in a airport-operated or an airport consortium, if you will, for wheelchair operations. They have counter-proposed that the port contract via a third-party contractor for the provision of those wheelchair services. However, they would like to see the rate methodology done in a very unique way with a customer facility charge rather than it being in rate base or a tariff charge here at the airport. So it's a rather complicated scenario. I know you've had some visibility of that, President Creighton. And so we're moving forward, but I think it would be prudent to have further discussions with the commission about the counter proposal that Alaska Airlines has made.
And when would that be ripe for a public briefing of the commission?
Well, they have asked, Alaska has asked to vet the proposal internally within their executive offices, and then to reach out to the other legal departments, corporate legal departments of their fellow airlines to form a legal consortium, which would result in the formation of an MOU, which would then go forward in the form of an RFP that the port would put out. So to answer your question, I didn't ask them for a specific deadline yesterday. I would think within the next 30 days they would have an answer in that regard, and I did brief Ms. Fassler on that as well yesterday.
Thank you, Michael. And I want to thank you and the rest of the airport staff for pushing this issue forward. Many people would say, why should the airport care about this? Why should the airport even get involved in this? This is an issue presumably between one of our tenants and labor. And from my standpoint, I think from the commission's standpoint, there's two reasons, particularly with the SkyCaps and the wheelchair workers. They're really our front door. And airline passengers don't differentiate between Alaska's SkyCaps or wheelchair workers or Southwest or United's wheelchair workers or SkyCaps. And I think it's important to have uniform standards, a cohesive front door, so to speak, and conditions where we don't have a revolving door of employees. And what I think the statistic as you describe it, 60% of the SkyCaps haven't been rehired?
Well, it would be, I believe that 75% have been retained, sorry.
Okay.
And
That's much better than the number I was originally given, but still.
Right.
I think it's important that we, we do present the best front door possible, and also, from a social responsibility standpoint, I have family ties with one of the airlines and the airline industry, And you look at, and I won't name names, but you know, you have airlines who've gone through troubled times recently, but you know, great airlines that have been built by the blood and sweat of their employees, and then you know, to have an airline go through bankruptcy, eliminate the pension plan for the entire employee base, and then come out of bankruptcy and implement a rich stock option plan for the top 100 executives, that to me doesn't show very good social responsibility. And while, you know, we shouldn't interfere so much in our tenants', you know, internal affairs, I think it's also, from our standpoint, incumbent upon us to really promote a good social responsibility ethic within our community. So with that, I don't want to belabor the point, but I'll open it up for comments from my fellow commissioners. Commissioner Charlton?
I just really want to echo Commissioner Creighton's comments about the amount of effort and commitment, Mike, that you and your team have shown in working this problem from all different perspectives, because every party has a legitimate view here, and what it takes to have a smooth operation and an effective business and a customer-friendly work environment at the Port of Seattle and at the airport and in all of our working environments just means that it takes a lot of work. And thanks a lot for doing it.
Well, thank you very much. We're looking for a win-win-win for the port, the airlines, and for our labor partners.
And I think that's important. And again, I think it's important to work collaboratively, but at a certain point, you have to say enough is enough and really put the, you know, the pressure on in terms of reaching a solution without any further delay. So thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
Commissioner Davis?
I just wanted to say that the idea of a consortium, which would make it uniform throughout the airport, is an idea that's come forward time after time. And at least on this issue, it seems like we're moving in the right direction, finally. and I appreciate that very much. I do have some questions about Alaska's proposal. I saw the chart. It seems so complicated. I really have need some answers before, you know, I don't think it's that hard. in terms of the funding, I don't think they disagree with maybe the consortium idea, but I would need some feedback on that. But this is a movement in the right direction to have the uniform service that we want to have, as Commissioner Creighton and Tarleton have said, at the airport, because they do meet and greet and they're the first public representatives. The SkyCap situation is more complicated, and we have to keep moving in the right direction on that, but it's not immediately solvable, I think, but we're moving, so thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis.
Okay, with that, I'd like to open it up for public comment, and first signed up, we have Keely Nye.
Evening, everyone. My name is Keely Nee. I represent SAGE, a nonprofit organization that focuses on economic and social imbalance. And I'm here to support our SkyCap and to focus on the SkyCap issue. And thank you for bringing up that issue beforehand, because you did get some of the important facts, but I want to give everyone else an update. As of today, four SkyCaps have been rehired, and I mean not 14, but 9 have been rehired, and 5 are left behind. I'm here to speak on their behalf. I mean, it's 5 people, and they do have their bills to pay. They have seniority, I think. They've been there for 15 to 20 years, and it's really unfair on how they're being treated. Deborah Guthrie, from the supervisor that used to work for Huntley, is now with Bags Inc. She had replaced these five workers who are left behind with her family members and her friends. And so to me, this shows favoritism and nepotism. And basically, I believe it sends a wrong message to workers who have faith in fairness and democracy. And for example, we have one of our one of our SkyCap who's been active with us, Tim Fuller, who has spoke passionately a couple weeks ago about his job and his coworkers. Tim has just recently found out that the reason he was terminated is because he stood for what he believed in, which was to bring his coworkers with him. And because of that, in result, he was terminated and he lost his job. So today I'm here to ask if all parties involved can hold any decision making until we find a resolution for this issue. And I have here a letter from 19 other local community organization that's very concerned with this issue as well. And so and also with me, I have James Taggart, one of our SkyCaps, and Michael Ramos from the City Church of Council, and he wants to voice his concerns about the issue as well.
Thank you, Ms. Nee.
May I ask a question? I just want to make sure I understood what you said, that one of the gentlemen who came to us and talked to us last or 2 weeks ago,
yes,
lost his job because he appeared before this commission?
Yeah, because he's been actively involved with us and sticking his head out to defend his other coworkers to bring them along with the new company. And because of that, he's lost his job.
So it's for activities beyond just appearing before the commission?
Yes.
Okay.
But he was hired by Bags and then?
He was originally supposed to be hired. Yeah.
Could we have a copy of your letter that you referenced?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank
and you. If you could provide it to
our commission.
Yeah,
sure. Donna Wynn. Thank you, Ms. Nee. Next, we have Mr. James Taggart.
I've never been here before, so be patient with me. I'm James Taggart. I started here as a SkyCap exclusively at SeaTac Airport July 5th, 1984. And so I've worked alongside Johnny Malone and many people who still are SkyCapping here and have same concerns that were being raised today and at other occasions. I grew up in an airline family. My father worked here at SeaTac Airport for 36 years as a ticket agent for Northwest Airlines. My mom was a flight attendant. My older brother's a pilot for American Airlines. And my younger brother used to work for Horizon. So it's in our blood. I grew up this way. I've been here. And many of you have probably seen me walking around the airport helping a variety of customers get to their locations. And as of today, I usually joke around with a lot of people. I'm very jovial, but today is kind of a sad day for me. I just came straight from the curb to here. After 23 years, this new company did not retain me, and when I asked them why, they gave me no reason. I do know that I was in an article this fall, August 27th, 2007, in regards to the union and variety of SkyCap issues. I was the main focus on the front page of the PI in the business section. I don't know, I was told about 3 weeks ago that this new company was taking over. We all ran upstairs and filled out an application that was one page long. We're given a 20-minute interview, and they never called the people that weren't hired. Which was very difficult. And when I asked when I wasn't hired, they wouldn't give me any reason. Although I've had some union involvement with Local 6, as you can tell from the article. I have a son with autism, and we've had difficulty paying our bills, struggled over the years. I've often worked 6 days a week to pay the bills. And my wife's worried about paying the bills. I'm concerned about paying the bills, and I've always felt my job was pretty secure. working as hard as I do, I very rarely take a day off. Even when I'm sick, I come to work to pay the bills. And so this has been a devastating blow to my family and to me. I was here in 1986 when one company tried to make us pull seniority, Ogden tried to make us pull seniority numbers out of a hat. And I pulled number 49 out and out of 61 numbers. And that shouldn't have been the way seniority was, because we already had a seniority roster. Eventually the port stepped in and basically told them to hire all of us back, and we were all hired back and got all our jobs back. And that was, I think, a decent thing to do. I think I speak for the other four individuals. One was in tears on the phone with me two nights ago. She clocked out Sunday night. She had been here 15 years as a SkyCap exclusively at Alaska Airlines. No reason was given to her. She wasn't hired. No reason was given to me. No reason was given to the other people that I know of why they weren't hired back. Although I saw the schedule today, and I saw friends and family members on there replacing us. One is a 18-year-old boy who was our bag runner, the son of the manager. I think that is so wrong. Wrong. I mean, it's unethical to me. I'm an ordained minister. I went to seminary, and I cannot fathom how wrong this is. And I just think something should be done. A motion to have a succession of seniority. I always thought our port seniority counted, and it does with the union. But something should be done where, even if they put us on a 90-day probationary period, that would be fair, you know, and then they can decide. I realize a tenant has a, they can choose who they hire or not, but I don't see any reason why I shouldn't have been hired, none. And I didn't do anything wrong. I can hold my head up high, I didn't. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now. And I hope that you would consider some action in this situation, because it's not right, not at all, not in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you, Mr. Taggart, and thank you for taking the time to come up here. And
thank you for allowing me to speak. I've never been here before.
Well, it's good to have you. Next, we have Michael Ramos.
Good evening, Mr. President and members of the Commission. My name is Michael Ramos. I'm the Director of Social Justice Ministries for the Church Council of Greater Seattle. We're a membership organization of 15 denominations and 419 churches in King County. We support James Taggart. We also support the SkyCaps who are currently employed. And we ask the port to help urge Alaska and Bags to hold up on a decision related to the current employees until all the parties can come together and work out a solution that's a win-win solution. The last time I spoke in a commission hearing at the airport was in the spring of 2001 in support of SkyCaps, and one by the name of Hosea, who is a prophet, the name of a prophet. James Taggart is a prophet in our midst, and we need to heed what he has to say. The SkyCaps and the security screeners that we supported in 2001 needed living wages and job security. We know from the tragic events later in 2001 that job security, training, and consistency in the workplace are high values, and there's a price to be paid when they're not afforded. SkyCaps have been here, like James Taggart, through thick and thin, through very difficult times in airport security. They need to be recognized and not terminated, nor be victims of retaliatory actions for their speaking up on behalf of security and stability in the workplace. These SkyCaps are dedicated, well-trained, and stable employees providing a service to the public and to the port. They keep baggage moving effectively and courteously, and this is a matter of security and safety that benefits the entire community. In a word, the port needs to foster a community standard where airport seniority is honored and job security is prioritized. We'll watch closely to see how we can follow up to be supportive of retaining this excellent and dedicated and honored workforce. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ramos. That ends our public testimony. Mr. Yoshitani.
Mr. President, the items 8A and 8B, there's been some new information which we were not able to provide equitably to the five commissioners. So you have different updates on this. These two items, 8A and 8B, so I would like to recommend that we defer these items to the next meeting.
Thank you. I think that's a good idea.
So the next item would be 8C, which is an authorization for the second floor HVAC design at SeaTac for an estimated cost of $214,650. Elaine Lincoln and Joel Nessel will provide the background.
I'm sorry. Good afternoon. I'm obviously not Elaine Lincoln, so I will fill in for her, and if she gets her, I'll let her take over. I am the project manager for this project, so I'll focus more on the technical side rather than the business side. But this project involves a new air supply system to the second floor of the central administration building. This area is currently occupied by Host. They have their current offices there, and it also is an area for their proposed new offices. The area has an inadequate air supply. What the project is involves is to utilize an existing mechanical room. Is to utilize an existing mechanical room on the roof of the main terminal building, bring an air duct supply system to the second floor of the central administration building, and this is the area where Host is currently occupied. The project also involves bringing the air supply duct system to the ticketing level to three concession areas located directly below, and this is the area on the north side of the second floor of the central administration building. Elaine, did you want to?
Good evening, Commissioners, Mr. Yoshitani. Just to give a little bit of introduction on this, Host and Seattle Restaurant Association is two of the three primary food and beverage operators who operate 35 restaurants here at the airport. Host also operates three duty-free shops here. There are approximately 30 employees that operate out of the administrative offices, and that includes human resources, accounting, their manager's offices, the cash room, their computer support system, maintenance, and their training. And as part of the land, as the landlord and as part of their lease agreements, we are responsible for including adequate amounts of utilities, and the tenants are responsible for the cost of designing and building out the space. And Joe can go into more of the technical if you.
And I did hit on some.
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, Joe. Are there comments or questions from the commission? Do I have a motion for approval of this item?
I move we adopt the recommendation of the staff.
Okay, Commissioner Bryant has so moved. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. President, next item is 8D, and this is Resolution 3597. This is a first reading declaring certain property surplus and authorizing its transfer to Highline Water District. Richard Otley and Bob York.
Good afternoon, Commissioners and Mr. Yoshitani. We are here today to request first reading of Resolution 3597, which declares surplus in approximately 800 feet of lineal water pipe, 8-inch water pipe, and authorize its transfer to Highline Water District. This resolution is a follow-up to the interlocal agreement between the Port and Highline Water District that the Commission authorized the Chief Executive Officer to enter into on the Commission meeting on February 12, 2008. The subject pipe is located along 160th Street, right in the parallel to the property that a consolidated rental car facility is located on. It has an estimated value of $37,500, and we don't have any future use for that pipe. The interlocal agreement and this resolution are the products of the cooperative discussions and agreements that have occurred between the Port and Highline Water District to define our water service boundaries, so that there was a clear understanding between ourselves and Highline which properties each party would be serving, and we're ready to proceed with that. And if you had any have any questions, I'd be pleased to respond.
Thank you. Are there any comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Charlton?
No, I was just going to move that we move resolution number 3597 for first reading.
Just one question.
Commissioner Davis?
This was part of what was being talked about at the legislative level and helped solve that problem.
That's correct.
All right. No further questions. Commissioner Hara has moved for first reading of resolution 3597. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. Next item is 8E. This is an authorization to increase the CIP for a ramp control tower for an amount of $69,000 for a total of $1.768 million. Bob Riley and Sean Anderson will give the background.
Good afternoon, Commissioners and Mr. Yoshitani. I'm Bob Riley, the Director of the Aviation Capital Improvement Program, and with me today is Sean Anderson, the Project Manager for the Ramp Control Tower Project. We're here to request an additional $69,000 authorization to complete the construction of the exterior access stairs for the Ramp Control Tower. This is a safety-related issue, and when the installation is completed, the Fire Marshal and Airport Building Department will be able to issue the permanent certificate of occupancy for the facility. There are a number of problems, as described in the Commission memo, that arose during the construction and delayed the project and drove up the costs. The most important factor was the lack of good information about the 1960s era tower that supports the new stairway. This affected both the design and construction of the project. For example, when we took the siding off, we didn't find what we expected. The structural members were different, and it required a field modification. We'd never like to have to come back to the Commission to ask for additional authorization, but I would say there's one good aspect to this, and that is that Sean and the Port Construction Services construction manager were really on top of the project, and I can assure you they did everything that they could to try to bring it in on budget. And they were also keeping a close eye on the budget, so they were able to stop work when it became obvious that we were going to need some additional authorization. In my opinion, they did good management on a difficult project. So Sean and I are here to request an additional $69,000 for the ramp control project, which brings the total authorization to $1,768,000. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Sean. Are there comments or questions from the commission? Do I have a motion for approval?
I move approval. Item 8E.
Commissioner Davis has moved for approval of aviation item 8E. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 The motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Mr. President, next item is 9A under general business, and this is an authorization to execute a one-year marketing agreement with the Seattle Convention and Visitors Bureau for amount not to exceed $234,700, and B.J. Stokey will provide the background.
Sorry about that. Technical stuff was never my strong suit.
Good evening, Mr. President, Commissioners, and Mr. Yoshitani, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to you tonight about international tourism. As you know, this is the 24th year of a unique partnership that we at the Port are lucky to participate in with the Washington State Tourism Department, the private and public travel sector industry in Seattle around the state, as well as the Seattle Convention and Visitors Bureau to promote international tourism to Seattle, the state, and our region from key markets. And those key markets are Japan, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and new this year, a program that we're starting to investigate opportunities in China, which we think will be very good for us in the future. The port's participation in this partnership is managed through the Seattle Convention and Visitors Bureau in a marketing agreement that we have had with them for a very long time. And I'm here today to ask for your continued support of this program. It is the heart and soul of what we do in international tourism at the Port of Seattle. And I would like to request that you authorize Mr. Yoshitani, our Chief Executive Officer, and give him the authorization to execute our one-year joint marketing agreement with the Convention and Visitors Bureau for 2008 in the amount of $234,700. And I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, BJ. Are there comments or questions from the commission?
Commissioner Davis?
You forgot to mention that tourism is an export.
Yes, it is.
It is. Absolutely. And we need to export everything we can from this state and this country and the financial situation we're in. I particularly like the idea that we're doing marketing in China because they hold $1 trillion worth of our funds. And if we can get a few of those back here, it might be a very good idea. So,
absolutely. And that's our aim and our goal. Thank you.
So, BJ, if you could just list off the countries that we have a presence in terms of our marketing efforts or working with partners.
Yes. Japan is our longest standing market. That effort was begun in the fall of 1983. And in the fall of 1985, we began efforts in the United Kingdom. Efforts in Germany began around 1989 for several years. They were then, as far as ports participation, put on hold for several years because of budget constraints. But that effort has been handled very well by the state tourism folks who have been bringing that forward. France, we worked in that market to establish a tourism presence for approximately 5 years very aggressively prior to the announcement of the Air France service. So as a result of the work that we did, we were in an excellent position to take advantage of the new service that, as you know, began last year. And our efforts there are going just fabulously. And we're very well established with our contacts, and there's a lot of excitement in the French market. And then, as I said, we are going to be starting, we hope, probably by June or July, we hope to have a representative in place in the China market and start those efforts as well.
And currently, as I understand it, the UK represents our largest market in terms of British tourists coming to Washington State, and then Japan is second largest?
Well, Japan is actually number one. The UK is number one to the United States as a whole because the tourism from the United Kingdom has been growing by leaps and bounds. Japan tourism is actually down to the United States, but interestingly enough, we are holding our own in that market. And we've gained a little bit. We haven't lost anything, and we have baseball to thank for that right at the moment. There are always new challenges in the Japan market because there are always new ways that the Japanese like to do things and new trends and so on. Right now they're tending to stay a little close to home. There are concerns about fuel surcharges. And there's even a bit of a concern still about perception of safety in this country, and also perception that sometimes the U.S. isn't very friendly because of some of the security things that they have to go through when they come into the country. But they love Seattle, and they love us, and most importantly, they love Ichiro.
All right. Thank you, Seattle Mariners, for
yes, at least for another few years. But we're always looking actively too. We thought about 4 years ago that we needed to really plan actively for life after Ichiro. Mm-hmm. And we have lots of ideas, and we're working on other kinds of things to encourage that travel here. But we've been kind of given a gift that's still our bread and butter for the moment.
And that on the tourism promotion trip last year, that was an issue, the issue that you mentioned of foreign tourists having at least a perception that mm-hmm. People aren't that friendly in the U.S. in terms of the customs and border patrol personnel and airport personnel just nationwide. And I've heard that issue in mm-hmm. Asia as well. Yeah. Has there been any progress in terms of working with the federal government and, you know, changing the perception, but also...
Well, as you probably all, the United States is severely underfunded when it comes to any kind of tourism promotion. It's actually very tragic compared to other countries. There are third world countries that are smaller than us that have bigger promotional budgets. So that's something we struggle with. Travel Industry of America, which is also known as TIA, and that's an organization that I belong to on behalf of the port in my daily tourism business that I conduct. And the president of that organization, Roger Dow, comes from the hotel industry. He's highly respected, and he is the first president that we've had of TIA that is very connected and knows how to lobby in Washington, D.C. So that is something that TIA is very dedicated to continue to work on. There are committees working on it. There's a lot of lobbying going on. I think it's safe to say that some things won't be happening until there's a change of administration sometime next year. So those issues are continued to be worked on, and we've made some progress, but there's a lot more to be made.
All right. Well, that is my three allotted questions. in the interest of moving forward, it's a very important issue, and I just want to thank you and the rest of the port staff for work on tourism issues in terms of making sure we get the traffic through the airport, because more passengers means lower cost, per passenger for the airlines, our tenants, and also more economic development for the region. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hara?
Yeah, I move item 9A. And I want to compliment BJ and the rest of the staff because of, it's kind of somewhat like the chicken and the egg. Which comes first, our activity in the foreign country or the airline that eventually will provide us direct service? And so I think it's a good move with Hainan coming in a few weeks. And I even saw their sign up coming into the airport today, which is a good thing, starting in June. So hopefully we'll get a lot of Chinese tourists that will be coming to Seattle, so in terms of dealing with that.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Hara. Commissioner Hara has moved for approval of item 9A. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. The motion passes unanimously. Thank you
very much.
Okay. With that, our next item, item 9B, is update on commission committees. I know since our last meeting, there was a meeting of the Special Investigatory Committee. Commissioner Bryant?
We have retained counsel, and I can tell you that the full investigative team is now on board. And after having introduced that team to the Department of Justice this morning, we will begin the investigation part of this work. At this time, I don't have any more detailed report, but I do anticipate having both a written and a oral report for this commission at the April 8th meeting.
Thank you. Are there any updates from the audit committee, or I think things have been relatively...
Well, the audit committee has met. We've updated our work plan. We do plan to meet on April 15th. We will invite as a permanent invitee would be the State Auditor's Office, and also Moss Adams will be continued to work with us. We have a very full agenda, so if you're at all interested, commissioners can be in the audience, I guess, but not fully participate, as a stand-in, but love to have you there, and also for the audience to be there too.
And the meetings are being publicly noticed.
The public meetings are publicly noticed. They're also being streamed as well, just as the commission meetings are.
Thank you, Commissioner Hara. Is there any update from the Resolution 3181 committee?
Well, we're continuing to resolve to meet our deadlines. We're meeting with our staff, who's working truly, truly wonderfully hard. Dakota Chamberlain is heading it up, but working with all of our staff on the construction side to try to renovate the Resolution 3181 Delegation of Authority consistent with the changes that that our CEO is making in terms of restructuring internally. And now that the legislation has been signed today, to make sure that we're consistent with that. And then whatever we are beginning to add ourselves with respect to visibility. So we're continuing that effort. And we are also making tracks to develop our citizens panel, which we hope will be able to start in April and May.
And I just want to echo Commissioner Davis's comments. Tom Barnard and Dakota have been pulling the lion's share of the effort, keeping things moving and keeping two commissioners trying to be on schedule.
Well, and it's complicated to make things simple. So we're trying to do that, to make it to clarify things as much as we can, but it is somewhat complicated with all the overlays of what is happening, especially on the construction side. There will be some others with respect to real estate and other elements of that authority, but that's the primary part.
Thank you. With that, our next item of business are trip reports, and I know we've had commissioners on a number of trips recently. We had the customer call. Commissioner Tarleton, would you like to give a short brief on that?
I just wanted to mention, actually, I did the customer calls with the CEO, Yoshitani, and Charlie Sheldon and Arif Goose regarding a Worldport Security Summit, and then customer calls in Korea and in Hong Kong and in Shanghai with airlines as well as shipping companies. And my principal objective was to both meet the customers as a new commissioner and also get the perceptions of our customers about really aggressive U.S. container security requirements that are now in play, requiring 100% container security scanning at foreign ports that are shipping to the United States by 2012 is the stated law right now. And I also wanted to get a sense of how our Asian shipping partners are thinking about expanding or contracting their shipping business to the Port of Seattle. And my primary impression is that we're going to have to work as a commission as well as with the leadership of the port to focus intensely in the next 4 years on aggressively reminding our long-term partners that the Port of Seattle is reshaping itself for the 21st century and that they want to come along for the ride because this is going to be the place that they want to be. I also had the opportunity to go to the Trans-Pacific Maritime Conference with Commissioner Hara and CEO Yoshitani and the container marketing team. And we all had different perspectives, I think, of what we learned there. But my key takeaway is that we're learning from the mistakes of other ports regarding environmental policies and strategies, as well as how we're dealing with the slowdown of the U.S. economy and the competition being waged by the Vancouver Prince Rupert port consolidation and the impending availability of the all-water service through the Panama Canal. And so I just had a reinforcement of the fact that we need to aggressively demonstrate why a green port and a diverse seaport really creates a competitive advantage to attract the Trans-Pacific shipping industry here during periods of market uncertainty and changes in the global economy. And we all can play a role in making that happen by being very attuned to listening to those customers and hearing why it is they might decide to come to Seattle instead of going up to Vancouver, or in addition to going up to Vancouver. Retaining some lines is really important.
Commissioner Hara?
Maybe just to quickly add some comments to the Trans-Pacific Maritime Conference. They had around 1,500 people that were there, representing the 3PLs, the steamship lines, the shippers, you know, the railroad people, along with the ports. And so you had a very interesting mix and divergent set of opinions regarding various elements of how to do business. Several key items came to light. One was the environmental. I think Gail briefly touched upon that. Just a day or two prior to our skidding there, Mayor Foster from Long Beach made it very clear as to what Long Beach's position was going to be in deference to the Port of L.A., which I guess it's last week they signed theirs on Wednesday. There is a deference politically, and clearly it was an issue between union versus non-union. I mean, that, the bottom line, that's where it's at in regards to the trucking industry. And he made no bones about it, and I thought he laid it out very, very straight. I think the other issues in terms of dealing with the economy, they had a whole bevy of economists. No one saw 2008 being a strong year, and that things will be flat or even dipping downwards. There was some great deal of concern. Obviously, this is right around when Bernanke was continuing making his cuts, and people were looking at it. This is before the Bear Stearns, et cetera, and all these other problems that have come up. And I think the other element was where shipping was moving and shifting. Clearly, the waterborne route had proven to be successful for East Coast ports. There was no question about it. More cargo was going through the Panama Canal and was avoiding the West Coast. And people had their different theories as to why that was happening, but it was interesting to listen to them as to their comments on potential traffic. And also there was a whole section on exports, especially in light of the falling dollar and how to enhance export trade. Maybe this is something Bill would be interested in. And that element, but it was a wide-ranging set of comments, and I think was well worth my time, and hopefully Gail and the rest found out. And this is one that Alec Fiskin always would chide us for not going to. So, but it was well worthwhile, I thought.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Hara, and Mr. Yoshitani. You actually went on both trips, so. Would you have any perspective that you could add?
I actually have nothing to add to those two very good summaries.
Okay. And I, for my part, went down to California earlier this month on the Flying Green Conference put on by UC Davis. I won't go into too much detail because it was a 3.5-day conference, and a lot of good information. I think it's been going on for 20 some years. Traditionally, it's been focused on noise issues as sort of the environmental issue of most concern to airport communities. But with increasing public awareness on emissions issues, they've now sort of established a dual track conference where there's panels on noise issues, panels on emissions issues, and sometimes going on at the same time, so you have to pick and choose. But a lot of good information on, had an Alaska Airline pilot talk about this idea of de-thrust takeoff, where you're not taking off at full power. And while that doesn't help greenhouse gas emissions necessarily, it does have a huge impact on decreasing nitrous oxide, which is a big concern to the communities. We had presentations on changing aircraft operational protocols, like continuous descent approach and advances on those. Had an interesting presentation from the UK Air Traffic Control Authority, where it's a tricky issue because the technology, where the technology stands these days if you try to address the noise issue and make engines quieter, you're actually increasing the emissions problem. So there's a, as the technology stands currently, there's a trade-off, and the air traffic control system in the UK seems to be a very dynamic system where they're constantly looking at how they can improve. And under 4,000 feet, their priority is the noise issue. Above 7,000 feet, their priority is the emissions issue. And between 4,000 and 7,000 feet, they, you know, it's sort of a mixture of priorities. Also had an interesting presentation by this group called the California Climate Registry, which has now, well, it was originally established by a number of primarily Fortune 500 corporations who wanted to get serious about addressing emissions issues and ahead of the curve, ahead of the regulations, but they didn't want to, spend money, make investments on technology that would reduce emissions and then have regulations imposed later on that would not give them credit for the emissions reductions they've already done. So they've established what's called the Climate Registry, where they can sign up and have independent verification of the baseline where they started from and where they're at now. And I think there's about 9 or 10 Western states who are now members of it, many Fortune 500 corporations, and I think the Oakland Airport has signed up. So that might be something to consider. I haven't talked to staff about that, but in terms of, if we're on this path where we're doing all this good work, for us to, look to sign up with that and get credit for all the work we're doing. And I talked to the presenter a little bit offline, and she said that she thought, for example, our greenhouse gas inventory at the airport, that from what she understood, the protocols were very similar to what they typically do, so they could look at what we've done without reinventing the wheel. So a lot of good information at the conference, and again, it was a conference that Commissioner Fiskin used to go to and recommended, and I think it was rather worthwhile. Okay, with that.
Was supposed to also follow up. There was a recommendation that we have a very brief, I may have even made the recommendation, that we have a very brief trip report written that can start being documented by Tom Barnard for us so that we can track what we travel to on behalf of the King County taxpayers. And at the end of the year, we can have a comprehensive documentation of not just how much money we've spent, but why we've spent it, and what benefit is being brought back to our knowledge collectively, as well as to the port teams, because they're traveling too, but we're talking to a more diverse or a different group of people. And it is a way of disseminating information across us, because we don't always have time to debrief each other. So if we could help Tom with that, I think he would appreciate our populating the database a little
bit. Well, he didn't go on the trip, so
exactly.
People who do will have to write something.
That's what I mean.
I think it's also important. It's important for audit purposes too, I think in the future.
So
we need to document what we do. I was going to report on my important trip to the Puget Sound Regional Council Executive Board on Western Avenue in Seattle. Actually, I'm not going to take a lot of time, but I would hope that you would put April 24th down on your calendars. It is the annual General Assembly, they call it. Bill Ruckel's house will be at the awards banquet, and the membership of the PSRC is really broad and deep, and it is important that elected officials do attend that. So, yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis. And also to Commissioner Tarleton's suggestion, I think that's a very good suggestion. We have in the past done written trip reports, but really just sort of on an ad hoc basis, and there's been no form or sort of standard procedure with respect to them. So I think it would be good to really get in that habit.
It would help to just bring the agenda back, and that could be a backup to the report of the substance that you have.
What this helps us do is also see how we're spending our time against the core priorities of the port. So as we're looking at our strategic objectives, we want our travel to in some way correspond with bringing back information and ideas that are directly correlated with the strategic objectives that we have for moving the port forward. And so that will be another way of tying it into our business.
Thank you. Is there any further business before the commission today? Seeing none, with that, the regular session of the Port of Seattle Commission for March 25th, 2008 is adjourned at 6:45 p.m. Thank you all.